So, do you ever look at society in the UK and despair and think, oh, everything's terrible? Are you one of those people? Maybe. Maybe if your wages haven't increased since the financial crisis in 2008. So maybe you know people who can't get jobs. Maybe you know that the employment rate is 3.9%. And there's 7.5% underemployment. People working fewer hours than they really wanted to. I'll get out of work mode in a minute. But there's lots of things about society that seem a bit broken. Obviously, I'm interested in the welfare system, which some people tell me is very broken. But if it is broken, then what's the solution? People have lots of different ideas, don't they? One idea that seems to be trendy at the moment is the idea of a basic income. It seems to be popular with both the libertarian left and the socialist. Sorry, libertarian right and the socialist left. It's the idea that the government pays everyone a certain amount of money to live off. Maybe it'd work, maybe it wouldn't. We can discuss after if you like, but it's clear that people long for a better world than the one we have at the moment. They want to make things better, but they're not quite sure how to do it. Well, what if we could offer a glimpse of a society marked not by greed and selfishness, but by generosity and charity? One where instead of all being in it for ourselves, we were truly, to borrow someone's phrase, all in it together. Well, if that vision is popular today, think of how much more popular it must have been in the past. Because, to be honest, we are quite comfortably off today. When I talk about unemployment, I hear the DWP press office in my ear telling me that it's at its lowest rate since 1974, and that there's a record number of people in employment. Apparently everything's fine. But things certainly aren't as bad as they were back in the time of judges. We read last time, didn't we, in Ruth 1, that this happens in the days when the judges ruled. And Judges ends with a horrific story of a woman from Bethlehem. She's married off to an abusive man as a concubine, sort of second-tier wife. Doesn't go very well for them, and we find them leaving Bethlehem on the way to Gibeah. They stop off at a town, and overnight the townspeople basically reenact the scene from Sodom with Lot. But instead of agreeing to their demands, they push out the concubine, and she's abused all night and left for dead in the morning. And then her husband decides to dismember her and send her body parts throughout Israel. And then, in case that couldn't get any worse, he lies about it and sparks off a civil war. It all ends pretty badly. Society at the time of the judges was in a terrible place. So in that context, Ruth chapter 2, which is also, probably not coincidentally, set in Bethlehem in Judah, comes as a ray of light piercing through the thick clouds of darkness. One commentary described it as an oasis in an ethical wasteland. But the story is about more than just ethics. It's not just about Ruth and her faithful labor. It's not just about Boaz and his loving kindness. It's not just about how Naomi turned from bitterness to blessing. No, the story is marked by the hand of God, the water of life who brings about the oasis in the wilderness. The one who was behind the scenes all throughout chapter 1, who was sovereign and good as he arranged, rescued and blessed, now becomes more visible. He still doesn't speak, but he's there as a sovereign protector, unseen yet forever at hand, unchangeably faithful to save, almighty to rule and command. He smiles and my comforts abound, his grace as the dew shall descend. The walls of salvation surround the soul he delights to defend. God delights to defend us. God's people are special to him. He protects and looks after them. Deuteronomy 32 verse 9 says, "For the Lord's portion is his people, Jacob his allotted inheritance. In a desert land he found him, in a barren and howling waste. He shielded him and cared for him. He guarded him as the apple of his eye, like an eagle that stirs up its nest and hovers over its young, that spreads its wings to catch them and carries them aloft." But what does it look like to be shielded and cared for, to be guarded, caught and carried? What does life look like in this ethical oasis springing from the water of life? What does it look like to live under the eagle's wing? Well, that's what Ruth chapter 2 is about. So let's read it. I'm actually going to start at verse 22 of chapter 1 because it's a nice recap. So Ruth chapter 1. It's on page 267, starting at verse 22. So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, arriving in Bethlehem as the barley harvest was beginning. Now Naomi had a relative on her husband's side, a man of standing from the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, "Let me go to the fields and pick up the leftover grain behind anyone in whose eyes I find favor." Naomi said to her, "Go ahead, my daughter." So she went out, entered a field, and began to glean behind the harvesters. As it turned out, she was working in a field belonging to Boaz, who was from the clan of Elimelech. Just then, Boaz arrived from Bethlehem and greeted the harvesters. "The Lord be with you." "The Lord bless you," they answered. Boaz asked the overseer of his harvesters, "Who does that young woman belong to?" The overseer replied, "She is the Moabite who came back from Moab with Naomi. She said, 'Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves behind the harvesters.' She came into the field and has remained here from morning till now, except for a short rest in the shelter." So Boaz said to Ruth, "My daughter, listen to me. Don't go and glean in another field and don't go away from here. Stay here with the women who work for me. Watch the field where the men are harvesting and follow along after the women. I have told the men not to lay a hand on you. And whenever you are thirsty, go and get a drink from the water jars the men have filled." At this, she bowed down with her face to the ground. She asked him, "Why have I found such favor in your eyes that you notice me, a foreigner?" Boaz replied, "I've been told all about what you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, how you left your father and mother and your homeland and came to live with a people you did not know before. May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." "May I continue to find favor in your eyes, my Lord," she said. "You have put me at ease by speaking kindly to your servant, though I do not have the standing of one of your servants." At mealtime, Boaz said to her, "Come over here, have some bread and dip it in the wine vinegar." When she sat down with the harvesters, he offered her some roasted grain. She ate all she wanted and had some left over. As she got up to glean, Boaz gave orders to his men, "Let her gather among the sheaves and don't reprimand her. Even pull out some stalks for her from the bundles and leave them for her to pick up, and don't rebuke her." So Ruth gleaned in the field until evening. Then she threshed the barley she had gathered, and it amounted to about an ephah. She carried it back to town, and her mother-in-law saw how much she had gathered. Ruth also brought out and gave her what she had left over after she had eaten enough. Her mother-in-law asked, "Where did you glean today? Where did you work? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." Then Ruth told her mother-in-law about the one at whose place she had been working. "The name of the man I worked with today is Boaz," she said. "The Lord bless him," Naomi said to her daughter-in-law. "He has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead." She added, "That man is our close relative. He is one of our guardian redeemers." Then Ruth the Moabite said, "He even said to me, 'Stay with my workers until they finish harvesting all my grain.'" So Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It will be good for you, my daughter, to go with the women who work for him, because in someone else's field you might be harmed." So Ruth stayed close to the women of Boaz to glean the barley and wheat, to glean until the barley and wheat harvests were finished. And she lived with her mother-in-law. Well, when this story starts off today, it feels very much like you're still in the wilderness of Judges, in a desert of blessing. Remember, chapter 1 ended with Naomi saying, "Don't call me Naomi, call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter." But as we said last time, there are little green shoots of hope in verse 22. The famine in the house of bread was over, and the barley harvest was beginning. The bud may have a bitter taste, but sweet will be the flower. And the presence of Ruth, the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, was the key to the future blessing. We see that almost straight away in verse 2. Ruth doesn't want to sit around and do nothing, does she? She wants to work. She needs to. She's hungry and wants food. She seems to know a bit about how the laws of Israel worked. She knows that she'll be allowed to pick up the leftover bits of grain in the fields. So Naomi tells her to go ahead. So, verse 3, she went out, entered a field, and began to glean behind the harvesters. Now, from Ruth's point of view, it's kind of a dangerous thing to do. She was a vulnerable young woman in a foreign country, and the text hints in several points that this wasn't entirely safe, which is no surprise when you consider what happened just outside Bethlehem in Judges 19. When we moved to Crocken Hill, Jay's mum was really worried about her getting the train. She was convinced it was unsafe. Not so much the train, they're pretty safe, but walking home. You see, there's a field between Crocken Hill and Swanley, and fields are very dangerous. Lots of places for bad people to hide. Well, we've never quite agreed with Jay's mum on that, but I don't blame her. She's just being a mum, isn't she? She's worried about her daughter. I'm told that's what mothers do. But Ruth here had left her mum and dad in a foreign country, and here she was in a dangerous field on her own, surrounded by men hard at work during the day and probably partying at night. So you'd imagine she's quite nervous. And especially when the owner of the field arrived, what sort of man was he? How would he treat her? Well, he gets off to a good start in verse 4. Just then Boaz arrived from Bethlehem and greeted the harvesters. "The Lord be with you." "The Lord bless you," they answered. It's probably just a greeting, but it's clearly the greeting of a religious man. And the workers respond in kind, so maybe Ruth is safe after all. And Boaz certainly seems interested. He asks the overseer, "Who does that young woman belong to?" And the overseer replied, "She is a Moabite who came back from Moab with Naomi." Do you notice, by the way, how many times it says Ruth is a Moabite? It's really quite unnecessary. It must be that the narrator is wanting to make a point here. Anyway, what would Boaz say to her? What would he do with her? Verse 8. So Boaz said to Ruth, "My daughter, listen to me. Don't go and glean in any other field and don't go away from here. Stay here with the women who work for me. Watch the field where the men are harvesting and follow along after the women. I've told the men not to lay a hand on you. And whenever you are thirsty, go and get a drink from the water jars the men have filled." Not only does he let her stay, he demands that she stays. He even provides water to drink, which would have taken hours to obtain for herself. He's a good guy. And Ruth notices that. In verse 10, she bowed down with her face to the ground and asked him, "Why have I found such favour in your eyes that you notice me, a foreigner?" Which is really the key question of this chapter. Why? Why are things so good now when they seemed so bad just a chapter ago? Why are things so good in Bethlehem here when they were so bad in the same town just a few pages ago at the end of Judges? Why? Well, at first glance, it appears to be because Ruth has impressed Boaz. In verse 11, Boaz replies, "I've been told all about what you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, how you left your father and mother and your homeland and came to live with a people you did not know before." But I don't think that the message the narrator wants us to take away from this chapter is that if we're a bit nicer to our mothers-in-law, then life will work out for us. See, Boaz proceeds to pray for Ruth, and his prayer, I think, contains the key to the whole chapter, where we see what's really going on. In verse 12, he says, "May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." That's what makes the difference. Ruth has come under the protective wings of the Lord, the God of Israel. It's an image that comes up again and again in the Psalms. Just one, for example, Psalm 91, verse 4 says, "He will cover you with his feathers, and under his wings you will find refuge. His faithfulness will be your shield and rampart." God loves to protect his people. Remember Jesus using similar language in Matthew 23, verse 37. You know, he's talking to Jerusalem, isn't he? Looking out over it on a hill and says, "Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who kill the prophets and stone those sent to you, how often I have longed to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you were not willing." What is it about this picture of God being like a bird sheltering his chicks under his wing? I think it links back to that bit I read from Deuteronomy at the start about how God is like an eagle. He swooped down into the desert and rescued us and brought us back to the safety of the nest. Because that's what's happened here, isn't it? God has swooped down into Moab and rescued Ruth and Naomi and brought them back to safety. And now he's sheltering them under his wings. This is a picture of what God has done for us when we were wandering far away from God. He swooped down into our lives and brought us back to God. Jesus has gathered us together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wing, just as he longed to do to Jerusalem all those years ago. We're the new Jerusalem, safe in the shadow of the Lord. He protects us. We're safe with him forever. But what does that protection look like? What are the marks of a life under the eagle's wings? Well, I think from this passage we see the first mark of life under the eagle's wings is providence, which is really just a fancy theology word for the truth that everything that ever happens happens under the loving control of our Heavenly Father. I wonder if when you read this, you thought that verse 1 is a little bit out of place. The narrator kind of interrupts the story to tell you about this random relative Naomi has. I mean, what's he got to do with anything? But then when you read verse 3, you read, as it turned out, she was working in a field belonging to Boaz. Now, as it turned out should make you sit up and think. Apparently it's literally as chance chanced, or, you know, as luck would have it. But you know this isn't luck, don't you? And the narrator knows it isn't luck. He's using the phrase to make you sit up and think. He knows Proverbs 16, verse 33. A lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. He doesn't actually think it's a coincidence. He's highlighting that everything that happens here is down to the providence of the God who shelters us under his wings. Nothing in our lives is a coincidence. Nothing happens by chance. We might say, as luck would have it, but it's not really true. But what does it mean for us then if one of the marks of life under the eagle's wings is God's providence? Well, it means we can just get on and do something, trusting in God's providence, which is what Ruth does here, isn't it? Ruth doesn't just sit around at home waiting to hear a vision from God telling her what to do. No, she gets out of bed, gets dressed, and goes to work. Notice the initiative all comes from Ruth here. Seems like Naomi's still caught up in despair. You know, why bother going out to work? Why not just sit at home and be miserable? Life's terrible nowadays. But if life under the eagle's wings is marked by providence, there's every reason to act. So you see a massive contrast between the two characters here. Trusting God's providence makes Ruth active when Naomi is passive. Makes Ruth hopeful when Naomi is hopeless. Makes Ruth determined when Naomi is in despair. If we trust God's providence, we can be like Ruth, who worked hard in faith, in the knowledge that God would handle the results. Because generally in life, we do need to just get on and do something. Sometimes Christians can think that we need to wait until we've heard a voice of God explicitly telling us where to go or what to do. It's just not how it usually works. A guy called Kevin DeYoung wrote a book called Just Do Something. I like the title. He asks, does God have a secret will of direction that he expects us to figure out before we do anything? The answer is no. God does have a specific plan for our lives, but it's not one that he expects us to figure out before we make a decision. As here in the book of Ruth, the plan, there obviously is a plan, but it only becomes clear at the end. None of it is revealed to Ruth beforehand. She just acts, trusting in God's providence. So what does that mean for us then, if we believe that about God? Well, another quote from that book. He says, so go marry someone, provided you're equally yoked and you actually like being with each other. Go get a job, provided it's not wicked. Go live somewhere in something with somebody or nobody. But put aside the passivity and the quest for complete fulfillment and the perfectionism and preoccupation with the future. And for God's sake, start making some decisions in your life. Don't wait for the warm, fuzzy feeling. If you are seeking first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, you will be in God's will. So just go out and do something. Isn't that fantastic? Anyway, being sheltered under the eagle's wings, trusting in the providence of God, means that we can get on and do something. Like Ruth, we can work hard in faith, leaving the results to God. So if the first mark of this life under the eagle's wings is providence, the second is provision. And we see that in a couple of ways in this chapter. Firstly, Ruth provided for Naomi. That's why she wants to go out and pick grain. Not just for herself, but for Naomi. In verse 6, we see that she worked so hard, the overseer noticed her efforts. And notice she still worked hard after the meal, even after Boaz met her and was so kind to her. She could probably have just put her feet up at that point and relied on Boaz to look after her. But no, in verse 17 we read, "So Ruth gleaned in the field until the evening. Then she threshed the barley she had gathered, and it amounted to about an ephah." Footnote tells me that's about 13 kilograms, which is quite a lot of grain. Apparently it's enough food for a month for the two of them. That can't have been easy work. Even if Boaz was giving it to her, she still had to collect it all and thresh it at the end of the day. And she wasn't just doing it for herself, was she? Verse 18, "She carried it back to town, and her mother-in-law saw how much she had gathered. Ruth also brought out and gave her what she had left over after she had eaten enough." She doesn't keep it all for herself. She shares with Naomi not just her grain, but her leftover lunch as well. I think in some ways, Ruth is a picture of a model employee. She works hard, but not for herself, for others. And we're to do the same, aren't we? Ephesians 4:28 says, "Anyone who has been stealing must steal no longer, but must work, doing something useful with their own hands, that they may have something to share with those in need." As employees, we work hard, but not for ourselves, but so that we can provide for others. I think sometimes we look down on Christians who earn a lot of money, as if they're less spiritual because they spend so much of their time working. It's not necessarily a bad thing. If God has given you gifts, which mean you can earn a lot of money, you can use them. But as with all gifts, he's given them not for your own benefit, but for the benefit of others. So by all means, earn the money, but then see how you can bless others with it. So we see provision on the part of Ruth for Naomi. She's a model employee who works hard in faith. But there's also provision by Boaz for Ruth. We see that he lets her glean in his fields, but he goes beyond what the law required. So in verse 14, at mealtime, Boaz said to her, "Come over here, have some bread and dip it in the wine vinegar." Not only does he invite her to lunch, he gives her more food than she could possibly eat. You have to imagine she was quite hungry. She'd been out in the field working all day with only one little break, and she probably hadn't had a massive breakfast. Ruth and Naomi didn't seem to really have anything, so I doubt they were living a life of luxury at home. But here, Ruth is given more food than she could possibly eat. And then, when they go back out again, Boaz tells his labourers to deliberately drop some grain so that Ruth could pick it up. Verses 15 and 16, "Boaz gave orders to his men, 'Let her gather among the sheaves and don't reprimand her. Even pull out some stalks for her from the bundles and leave them for her to pick up. Don't rebuke her.'" The law says that Ruth was entitled to pick up the grain that fell on the floor, but Boaz was making his men drop even more. He wasn't required to do that. Boaz in this picture is a picture of what the Bible often calls loving kindness or covenant faithfulness. The word is used quite regularly in this book. It's used of Ruth in the next chapter, but in this chapter it's used in verse 13 of Boaz. Naomi says, Ruth says he's spoken kindly to her. And it's used of God by Naomi in verse 20. "He has not stopped showing his kindness to us." Boaz reflects the loving kindness of God. He shows a generosity that goes beyond what is required. It seems like the kindness God has had for Boaz overflows in his kindness to the other people in his life. So sheltered under the wings of God's kindness, we see reflected kindness on display. Boaz is a picture of a model employer. He doesn't see his duty in life as to maximize profits from the farm. If he thought that, he wouldn't be deliberately scattering grain for Ruth. We often think that that is the job of a business, don't we? But I don't think it's the way God sees things. Just to prove I'm not just making this up, theologian John Calvin says that if we're given riches, we can't just enjoy it ourselves. He said, by using it moderately, he should employ the property that has been given to him in order to help and to provide for his neighbours, seeing himself as God's steward, who possesses the goods he has on condition that he must one day render an account. Whoever has a great quantity of it should only take enough to eat, so that whoever has hardly enough might not be in want. Saying we don't really own our wealth, we're just stewards of it. God has given us that money so that we can provide for others. I don't think the Bible specifies how much we have to provide for others, and I don't think there's like a maximum level of riches we're allowed to keep for ourselves. But I do think those are questions we need to think through. What would God have me do with my money? It's not just there to make me richer. So if I'm running a business, I shouldn't be so concerned about making as much money as I can as about using my business to provide for the needs of others. I think when I walk to work, I walk past a Timpson's shop and there's a sign saying, offering unemployed people free dry cleaning before a job interview. It doesn't make them any money, but it's a good thing to do, isn't it? That's the kind of thing Christian business owners should be doing. So if life under the wings of the eagle is marked by providence and provision, but also by protection. That's how the phrase is often used in Psalms, isn't it? That God will shelter us under his wings to protect us. And we see some of that coming out here, don't we? Ruth, in this chapter, is primarily protected by Boaz. She's protected, in verse 9, from sexual harassment. As a manager, I find HR incredibly tedious, but they do have their uses, I suppose. In verse 9, Boaz says, "I've told the men not to lay a hand on you," which I think is the oldest recorded sexual harassment in the workplace policy. So clearly the Bible says HR policies are a good thing, unfortunately. But God cares about the vulnerable and wants them to be protected. And as a good employer, Boaz was doing that. Ruth was also in danger as a foreigner. She's very conscious of that in verse 10, isn't she? "Why do you notice me, a foreigner?" We read, didn't we, in that psalm earlier, that God upholds the cause of the oppressed and gives food to the hungry. The Lord watches over the foreigner and sustains the fatherless and the widow. Deuteronomy says that we must therefore love the stranger, like God does, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. And we must love the stranger because we were loved by God even when we were strangers to him. So Boaz reflects the concern that God has for the foreigner in this story as he demonstrates the loving kindness of God by loving the stranger, Ruth. And Naomi recognizes this protection, doesn't she, in verse 22. "It will be good for you, my daughter, to go with the woman who worked for him, because in someone else's field you might be harmed." Boaz is again displaying the loving kindness of God. And love, as 1 Corinthians 13 tells us, always protects. As Christians, we are called to protect the weak. We see that modelled by Jesus, who protects the woman caught in adultery from stoning. Or when on the cross, even as he's dying, he cares about what happens to his mother and asks the disciple he loves to look after her, to take her into his home. And the church must protect its weaker members. That's why Laurie asked Ruth where her stick is, and cares about her getting home safely. That's why the first deacons were appointed to oversee the distribution of bread to make sure the Greek-speaking Jews weren't missed out. And nowadays, our deacons are responsible for ensuring the vulnerable in our church are looked after. That's why Richard had the idea to appoint a care coordinator so no one gets missed out. So life in the shadow of God's wings should be marked by providence, provision and protection. But this might be controversial. I think it's also marked by policy. What do I mean? Well, God's protection and provision weren't just down to generous employers and faithful labourers. God has a special concern for the weak, as we've said, and we must love the stranger because we were loved by God even though we were strangers. That's all true, but God did more than just command us as individuals to love the stranger. It's true that as a church, our main aim is to go preach the gospel to all nations, baptising people, making disciples and baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey all that he has commanded us. And by doing that, we will transform society and it will look more and more like this. But that's not the only thing that Christians can do. In the Old Testament, God made provision in his law for the stranger, the poor, the foreigner, the widow, the orphan. Leviticus 19:9-10 says, "When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not wholly reap the corners of your field, nor shall you gather the gleanings of your harvest. You shall leave them for the poor and the stranger. I am the Lord your God." So God didn't just provide for the poor by telling individual believers to give to charity or to help their neighbour. He also set up a whole system so that the poor would be provided for. Because God knows that you can't trust individual humans to do it. We are fundamentally selfish, aren't we? So structures put in place so that to ensure the poor are cared for are a good thing. Now, in the church, we said that's the structure of having deacons, but what about in society? Well, we started off by saying that everyone has their own ideas on how to make society a better, kinder place, but is there a Christian answer? Can we say anything about how God thinks society should be ordered? Well, I think some Christians who love their Bibles get a bit too literal here. They say, well, you know, it says that you shouldn't glean to the edges of your field, so we need to program our combine harvesters to stop 2 metres away from the hedge so there's some left over for the poor. I don't think we can do that, can we? Our society today is quite different from Israel 3,000 years ago. You can't directly apply the Old Testament law to the UK today. And anyway, the law was given for a special purpose, to prepare Israel for the Messiah, but now the Messiah has come. And the nation God's preparing today isn't a physical nation, but a spiritual one. A people, spiritually speaking, plucked from the nations by the great eagle and protected in his nest. So the Old Testament civil law doesn't apply to us in the UK today. But it does teach us about the character of God. And if back then God wanted laws to be put in place to ensure that the poor were cared for, then it makes sense that he might want the same thing today. That we should have laws which ensure that the vulnerable are not neglected and abused, that the poor are fed and that orphans are cared for. As Christians, I think we can go beyond saying that we should just individually live good lives. I think we should seek to have society ordered in a more just way than it currently is. So we can work together with non-Christians to make sure that our laws are just and provide for the weak and the needy. In our last Bible study series, we saw examples of that in history, like Wilberforce campaigning for the abolition of the slave trade based on his Christian principles. He did more than just not own slaves himself. I think of charities today like Home for Good. They both work to encourage Christians to be involved in adoption and foster care, which is a good thing. But they also campaign for improvements to the laws surrounding the care of vulnerable children, which is also a good thing. So, life under the eagle's wings is marked by providence, provision, protection, and also makes us want to form policy that reflects God's character. Finally then, we see that life under the wings of the eagle leads to praise. What a turnaround we see in Naomi. At the end of chapter 1, she's so bitter about how the Lord had treated her. But in chapter 2, verse 20, she says, "The Lord bless him." Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "He, that is almost certainly God, has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead." She added, "That man is our close relative. He's one of our guardian redeemers." Whereas before Naomi thought God was against her, now she recognizes that she has come to shelter under the wings of the eagle. She's benefiting from the kindness God showed towards her and Ruth, and also to her late husband. In chapter 1, we couldn't quite make it out through the clouds of gloom, but now we see it clearly. As we said last time, behind a frowning providence, he hides a smiling face. I think in some ways this chapter is like the scene in the movie where the two main characters meet for the first time. How will they get on? Will they like each other? I think you can almost imagine that Naomi's telling this story as a narrator, telling us about when her adopted daughter and soon-to-be son-in-law first met. Reflecting back, she's overcome with praise to the God who, in his providence, has provided for and protected her. Isn't that our reaction when we look back over our lives? Maybe at the time things were so murky and we couldn't see how God could possibly be doing something good. But now they've become clearer. Our bitterness turns to blessing as we see that throughout it all, we were sheltered under the eagle's wings. We had a sovereign protector, unseen yet forever at hand, unchangeably faithful to save, almighty to rule and command. He smiles and my comforts abound, his grace as the dew shall descend. The walls of salvation surround the soul he delights to defend. Well, we're going to sing that song now. In the phrase books, it is number 774.